night lodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're listening to episode 682 of Unwelcome Guests, the commercially controlled media. I'm Robin Upton, and that particular phrase is a bit of a mission of mine. I'm trying to replace what I think is a highly misleading characterization, mainstream media. You may remember 10 episodes ago, we looked at mainstream or extreme on how commercially controlled media outlets work hand in hand with government and other hierarchical organizations to promote a highly sociopathic and oftentimes murderous agenda, which doesn't seem to me in any way reflective of most of humanity's ambitions. So, in the light of that fact, I haven't referred to them as the mainstream media for many moons now. And I'm exasperated to find how many people still call them that. Self-styled mainstream, perhaps. Now, back in episode 12, almost 14 years ago, we heard the story of Steve Wilson and Jane Aker suing Fox TV after they were fired for refusing to lie on air. The result of that case, of course, and I don't suspect that you've heard this on the commercially controlled media, is that news programs have no obligation to tell the truth. Just one of so many extra remarks I'd like to make about this film, but I'm going to curtail them to fit in for the second half of our second hour this time, some pretty blood-curdling stuff which you won't be picking up on the commercially controlled media, from Jeremy Scahill about the reality which lies behind the micromanaged infotainment served up as war reporting by the commercially controlled media. Now, our main piece this week is a 90-minute film adaptation of a 2012 film entitled Shadows of Liberty about the unwholesome reality of the commercially controlled media in the US. A film by Jean-Philippe Tremblay.
In this country, the most powerful country on earth, it is so actually difficult to get information, especially outside our borders, not to mention what's going on inside this country.
Janine Jackson, Program Director of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting.
Public information, the news we rely on to learn about what's happening in the world, to learn about one another, is in the hands, basically, of commercial enterprises.
Deepa Kumar, Associate Professor of Media Studies at Rutgers University.
Giant media corporations like Time Warner, News Corporation, Disney, and so forth, they get to decide what is newsworthy, and what is not newsworthy.
This is America! How many of you people want to Julian pay for your Assange. Neighbor's mortgage?
What the press is pushing is distortions, lies, lack of balance.
I have 900 channels on my TV, but 700 of them are
selling the news.
So many great celebrity stories. Thank God.
Oh, look at that. She's
that's
so
a
humble.
Woman.
Yeah.
She's we think we have a lot
Robert
of news
Chesney,
to tell you about
professor,
Anna
author,
Nicole
activist,
Smith,
journalist, and media critic.
We have a commercially driven journalism that has no interest in poor people, but they're basically written out of the picture altogether. And we have a system that tells us what people in power are interested in and what they want to talk about.
Danny Glover, actor, director, and political activist.
Make no mistake about it. Is to control people's ideas, is to control their imagination.
Also reminded him that the channel was part of the establishment, so he must conduct himself accordingly.
You executives to put on positive stories.
You have pressure from news executives to put on positive stories.
They wouldn't say it in that way, but they would edit my pieces, they would push me in different directions, they would turn down stories that were more critical.
We're in a profound crisis of democracy. You can't choke off discourse and have a free society.
This is what you get with corporate media.
These are stories you will not be told on radio, in newspapers, or on television. A clash between two worlds. Big media corporations spinning public perception for profit versus the defenders of truth who stand for liberty and democracy.
And that's our news for tonight.
Shadows of Liberty.
Human Billboards. Roberta Baskin, chief correspondent for CBS News from 1992 to 97.
I'd often been asked if there was any pressure on me because of the kinds of stories that I do. I was always asked, are there some stories that you can't do? Are there some times that you're not allowed to report on certain things because of advertisers? And my answer was always, absolutely not.
Two decades after the end of the Vietnam War, the United States lifted the trade embargo against Vietnam. And CBS chief correspondent Roberta Baskin looked into one corporation's search for cheaper labor markets.
The premise for the story was the fact that Nike were subcontracting to these factories on the other side of the planet, but they weren't really taking responsibility for how the shoes were made. And I asked to follow the trail.
In August of 1996, Baskin and a CBS News film crew flew to Vietnam to investigate the Nike factories.
We were able to kind of peek through the keyhole, but we were not allowed inside. We were barred.
As Baskin waited outside the factory gates, what she heard from the workers would forever change her views on Nike.
One of the things that really shocked me was to discover that the word Nike had become a verb. The word Nike meant to abuse your employees. There were incidences of physical abuse. Women who had their mouths taped shut for talking on the line. 15 women were systematically hit with the top part of a Nike shoe around the face and the neck. It was this disparity between seeing the corporate image that the company sells and the reality in these factories. Just do it, or else.
Roberta Baskin's news report about Nike abuses was broadcast on CBS News television across the United States.
CBS was very pleased submitting it for prestigious awards. For me, what was really exciting about it was that the phones rang off the hook. There was picketing of Nike towns across the country. There were boycotts that were being organized by students on campuses. I realized that it had touched some kind of a nerve.
Nike's labor abuses reached the media, and the shoe giant came forward to limit the damages.
Phil Knight, chairman of Nike.
We don't have abusive labor conditions in our factories, and really never have.
With Nike in denial, CBS News commissioned Baskin to do a follow-up investigation, working with a Vietnamese labor group.
Nguyen Nguyen, founder of Vietnam Labor Watch.
Roberta's work was mainly about the corporate punishment. We help add another dimension to the problem is that the wages and excessive amount of overtime.
Nike's 1997 annual profit, $795 million, compares with the average salary of 16 cents per hour.
Nike's not the good guys, even though they've done a lot of commercials saying they are, but people at that moment realize that they are not part of the good team.
As Baskin was putting together the updated news report on Nike's labor practices, she received unexpected news from inside CBS.
I got a call from my executive producer who said the story is not going to air. It's been taken off schedule. There's some sort of deal being made between Nike and CBS News for the upcoming Winter Olympics. The air went out of my soul.
Brian Healy, producer of CBS News. 1972 to 2010.
CBS News was paying an enormous amount of money for the rights. And so by definition, they would be seeking out commercial sponsors who would pour lots of money into it so that they could recoup the millions that they were paying for the rights of the Olympics.
The 18th Olympic Winter Games on CBS.
As CBS revealed their Olympic coverage, the deal between Nike and CBS was plain to see.
Correspondent after correspondent are wearing these Nike jackets on the air with a little CBS something or other. You really couldn't read it, and a big swoosh on the shoulder. That was the deal. Nike had convinced CBS News to turn its correspondents into billboards. It was heartbreaking.
The CBS News correspondents were furious. They had to wear the Nike parkas whenever they appeared on air. It's just not done.
Baskin wrote a memo requesting CBS management to take the Nike logo off the correspondents.
CBS had crossed this incredible line. How do you trust serious stories when you're seeing the reporter wearing a bunch of logos? Immediately, the president of CBS News responded, saying this was a breach of professional etiquette. It meant that I should shut up. How dare I raise a question about the integrity of CBS News?
After questioning the deal with Nike, Baskin was removed from her position as the chief correspondent of CBS News.
It wasn't an ordinary transfer, a change. It was a demotion. And it was a demotion that was to send a message.
I ended up asking if I could get out of my contract. The president responded, great. They were, you know, happy to see me go.
To this day, the CBS network has buried both of Baskin's reports on the Nike sweatshops.
Janine Jackson, Program Director of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting.
These are the kind of fundamental conflicts of interest that result in censorship, that result in a narrow debate, and they come directly from the fact that we have made these historical choices to allow corporations to own and control our media.
Media today is dominated by a handful of corporations. This is a far cry from the original ideals of the country.
The birth of the free press.
As Americans fought for independence from imperial rule, the revolution found its inspiration in an unexpected place.
John Nichols, author and journalist from The Nation magazine.
The United States was in many senses founded by a journalist, Tom Paine, who called Americans to revolution against a British Empire that was thought to be completely unbeatable. This country was really founded on the concept that if you gave citizens the information they needed, they could govern themselves.
The founders of the United States gave citizens the fundamental right to a free press.
A revolution for freedom of information.
Robert McChesney, communications professor, author, and journalist.
One of the primary reasons for freedom of the press was that it was the only way people outside of power could keep the government from becoming an empire. Stop militarism, stop the corruption, the secrecy, and the cronyism. That was the function of freedom of the press.
Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!
There's a reason why our profession, journalism, is the only one explicitly protected by the U.S. Constitution. Because we're supposed to be holding those in power accountable, asking the critical questions.
One of the first steps of the new government was to encourage the distribution of independent news through subsidies.
There's a quote from Frederick Douglass, "Knowledge makes man unfit to be a slave."
This was actually America's revolutionary contribution. The genius of the subsidies is that it did not discriminate against the content of the newspapers.
The abolitionist movement didn't start in Congress. It started in those freely distributed weekly newspapers. And that was really where we began to address the most fundamental sins of the American experiment.
It's simply information that is power. It's information that frees us, because when people get information, they then can decide what to do.
Today, the founding vision of America's journalistic independence
has become deeply distorted.
Media is the conversation we have as a society. It's the way we learn about the world. It's the way we learn about one another. We see the range of public debate constrained because there may be many things that citizens of a democratic society need to know about that private corporations may not be interested in telling them.
Don't go there. Christina Borgeson, journalist and producer in CBS from 1994 to 97.
There are what I call black holes in journalism. There are certain events and certain subjects that you may not cover.
On the night of July 17, 1996, flight TWA 800 was en route from New York City to Paris, carrying 230 passengers, when disaster struck.
Bringing you up today to TWA flight, a 747 aircraft has gone down.
See in the water down there.
James Kallstrom, FBI Director, New York Office.
That day I was at CBS, and my executive producer called me down and told me to look into it. And it completely changed my life, shifted my paradigm.
As Borgeson investigated the crash for CBS News, many people reported something disturbing they'd seen in the night sky.
All these eyewitnesses said they'd seen something go up, then they followed it up to where the plane was, and then all of a sudden the plane exploded.
With different reports emerging about TWA 800, the FBI declared the surrounding area a crime scene.
If it is a terrorist event, we then have the challenge to find out who the perpetrators were, who the cowards were that did this.
As Navy divers were called to recover the plane's wreckage, rumors of friendly fire emerged.
That first FBI press conference I went to, some guy raised his hand and he said, "Why is the Navy involved in the recovery when they are suspect?"
There's a video of the FBI press conference, and there's a chap with a sign which says, "We demand an independent people's investigation, World Workers' Party."
Kallstrom just pointed at him and he goes, "Remove him!"
And indeed, he is manhandled out of the meeting by a group of about five men acting in concert.
And then everybody continued as if this hadn't happened. And to my mind, we should have all pressed on that question.
It's military, that friendly fire was not involved in this incident. And I used the strongest terms I could use. I said it was highly, 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 highly unlikely.
Despite FBI denials, Borgeson's research uncovered a different scenario based on the Navy's activity on the night of the disaster.
When they released the radar information, they only gave half of it. They cut it off right when you could see that there were all these military vessels in this exercise zone that was right there.
Kelly O'Meara, congressional aide, New York, 1981 to 97.
Not only were there ships there, but there actually was a live fire exercise going on off the coast that night. And that's why they had closed down the flight corridor that is parallel to the commercial flight path.
TWA 800 center. TWA 800, if you hear center ident. TWA 800 center.
I think that was him.
I think so.
God bless.
When there's a distress, you're supposed to, by law of the sea, go and try and help. These ships went in the absolute opposite direction, away from the crash site and at 30 knots.
The search for clear-cut evidence continued, and Borgeson was offered a piece of seat fabric from the plane, that had undergone preliminary testing.
Philip Weiss, journalist in the New York Observer, 1996 to 2006.
The test had revealed that there were heavy metals in it that were consistent with a missile strike that went through the plane at a certain point where this seat was very close to. And Christina received a sample to do independent verification.
I mean, it was just amazing. How many times do you get hard evidence from something? I had no idea there was going to be any problem whatsoever.
As CBS News gave Borgeson the go-ahead to accept the seat fabric, she was close to discovering whether a missile strike had brought down the plane.
And I was looking around for a lab, and that's when the FBI called and said, "You have a piece of stolen evidence." To my great disappointment and dismay, CBS just gave it right back.
CBS has given federal investigators a piece of cloth purportedly from the downed TWA Flight 800. The FBI wanted the fabric because...
CBS folded like an ice cube in the sun. They just went. They decided this is not a story we're going to fight for. It was a great moment of spinelessness on the corporate media's part.
No evidence
has been found which would indicate that a criminal act was the cause of the tragedy of TWA Flight 800. The law enforcement team has looked at every theory and has left no stone unturned.
With eyewitness accounts of a possible missile strike still unexplained, the CIA produced an animation that was broadcast nationally.
When they showed that animation, it wasn't like they then went out and talked to the fishing boat captain who had seen something completely different.
Flames visible to eyewitnesses more than 40 miles away.
I did. And they said, "This is ridiculous. This is not describe what I saw."
As the aircraft descended, it produced an increasingly visible fire.
The video was shown on network TV. It was shown nationally. It was shown over and over.
To date, there is no evidence that any eyewitness saw a missile shoot down TWA Flight 800.
The press bought it. The press bought the government's version of events.
At the time of the disaster, Westinghouse, a nuclear power company and major defense contractor, owned CBS News.
Any logical person would go, well, where does the vast majority of their money come from? Government contracting. If Christina were getting too close to the truth, would they shut down the investigation or would they lose their government contracts? I mean, these are logical questions that you have to wonder. What's more important to CBS?
Ultimately, Borgeson's pursuit of what happened that night challenged the priorities of corporate media.
I walked into this meeting of news executives. I said, "Why aren't we covering this?" And one guy looks up at me and he goes, "Oh, you think it's a missile, don't you?" And I said, "I don't know what it is, but I'll tell you, it's not a straightforward thing. There's something going on here." And there was just this silence, and I was just looking out at this sea of white shirts. And as I turned around and left, I just thought, God, you know, my goose is cooked here. And it was, you know. I was out a few weeks later.
The government's official explanation of the disaster, mechanical failure, hasn't been proven, and questions still remain.
I can't tell you with absolute certainty what happened. When that many people die, you owe it to them and to the other people who are getting on those planes every day to find out what really happened.
When you have corporations whose economic interests are very much tied into the agendas set by governments, it's easier to let go of an individual journalist who's seen as a troublemaker than to shake up an entire system which is based on the notion that official sources are never wrong.
The international silver.
The rise of media empires.
Just as newspapers had been the driving force behind democracy, the great hope of the 20th century was the birth of mass media.
We think Google and Facebook is a big deal. Imagine what it must have been like in rural Kansas to suddenly be able to listen to a broadcast from New York City every night. How that collapsed the world in ways that's very difficult for us to conceive of today.
Let's drop backstage as Osgood Perkins, the star, arrives. And now we move down 45th Street to the Music Box Theater.
Wall Street crashed. The financial house of cards collapsed. And the overinflated stock market plunged into a Great Depression.
In 1933, with the Great Depression and the nation in a state of panic, President Roosevelt took to the airwaves.
You people must have faith. You must not be stampeded by rumors or guesses. Together, we cannot fail. And it is up to you to support and make it work.
It was apparent to people at the time that the control over this medium was going to be a form of social control.
Lucky strike means flying
this
the back.
This is NBC, the national broadcast.
With advertising money pouring in, corporate networks pressured Congress to uphold profit as the basis for American broadcasting.
Your cigarette tastes different lately.
Business was publicly owned property, and lots of Americans protested that we would turn over this scarce resource, these extraordinary airwaves, to a handful of private commercial interests to make money by selling advertising to us.
Decided to tackle this job of telling on the air.
In 1934, Congress passed the Communications Act, sealing the future of America's broadcasting as a for-profit system.
NBC, CBS, ABC, these huge empires, were built upon the gift for free of monopoly rights to government property. It was an extraordinary corporate welfare that boggles the mind.
Mass media makes over $236,000 million a year in advertising revenue.
A recent study found that anywhere between 40 and 70% of what is considered news is an idea that came out of a corporate PR department. The media should have a social responsibility, and unfortunately, that does not happen in the current context.
The new media monopoly.
With broadcasting set up as a commercial enterprise, government regulations were put into place to prevent monopolies.
There was a cross-party agreement that commercial activity would be regulated by the government. No individual should have such dominance of our media that they could effectively define the discourse. The great transition came in the election of Ronald Reagan as president of the United States.
Government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
Ronald Reagan believed the answer to any concern, any question as regards how to create a good media system was to get government out of the way.
Limits on advertising during children's programming were relaxed.
In order to restructure media ownership, Reagan removed regulations.
Driving the bears back into permanent hibernation, we're going to turn the bull loose.
License renewal for broadcasters were deregulated.
Their whole model was the idea that if you removed all controls and regulations and allowed the free market rip, then everything would be fine. Everything would be wonderful.
Limits on concentration of ownership were relaxed, and the requirement to give equal airtime to political candidates was dropped.
In reality, what it does is it allows a handful of giant corporations to come in and gobble up everything. And these conglomerates don't see journalism as actually being central and essential to the functioning of a democracy. Their main interest is making profit.
One merger symbolized the takeover of mass media by conglomerates seeking ever higher profits.
For General Electric, here is Ronald Reagan.
Good evening on this last Sunday before Christmas. The Christmas season is a time for the family. So
people should remember that Ronald Reagan was funded by large corporations. And so suddenly we saw a radical transformation of the media system in the United States.
General Electric and RCA, two of America's biggest and best-known companies. In a dramatic move last night, the two announced plans to merge this high-tech, multi-billion-dollar Wall Street wedding, complete with a major television network.
We'll now have the strongest network. We'll have a stronger defense piece. This is going to be one dynamite company.
A concentration of mass media in the hands of a very few, very large international corporations who have a lot of different businesses, defense business, theme parks, and news became a smaller and smaller part of ever larger corporations.
The Reagan administration approved General Electric's purchase of major media holdings despite ongoing violations of industry laws and practices.
Deceptive advertising of light bulbs, fraudulent nuclear missile contract, $30 million fines for defrauding the Defense Department, money laundering in the sale of military jet engines, toxic contamination of the Hudson River, human experiments in nuclear testing, unfair debt collection practices, and price fixing.
Meanwhile, from General Electric, from my family and myself,
David Simon, author and journalist, creator of The Wire.
The original sin was going to Wall Street. The demands of Wall Street will require empty desks in your newsroom. So why don't you minimize your actual product and make more money? Capitalism is not the best judge of what's good for a society.
Over 166 U.S. newspapers have closed down or stopped publishing a print edition since 2008.
When I knew it was time to go, the last speech I got from a CEO, he had been selling cereal, breakfast cereal, before he was selling newspapers. He came into Baltimore, he gave a speech about product. He never once mentioned news. He never once mentioned the role of a newspaper.
Over 35,000 jobs have been cut from the news industry since 2008. Norman Solomon, journalist, founder of the Institute for Public Accuracy.
Corporate mission is to sell things, to delude and to deceive, to do damage control when unpleasant stories come up.
Killing the messenger.
One of the biggest news stories of the 1980s was the explosion of crack cocaine in the United States.
It's another night, another crack raid. Today, crack cocaine use here is an epidemic.
Robert Parry, journalist, Consortium News and Associated Press, 1974-87.
Well, the crack epidemic not only destroyed lives in the sense that people were addicted to this powerful drug, but also it set off gang wars. Certain communities, like the African-American communities, were disproportionately hurt. Gary Webb, he began investigating that.
Charles Bowden, author and journalist.
Gary Webb, he thought being a reporter was the best thing he could be. The only independent force in society to establish truth.
What Gary Webb witnessed in a courthouse would lead him on a journey to uncover the origins of the crack epidemic in America.
What first caught his eye, he's got Nicaraguans, obviously dirty in a drug deal, and they're not going down, they're getting a walk. Well, if you're a reporter, you look into that.
As Webb looked at the suppliers of the crack trade in Los Angeles, the trail led back to a U.S.-sponsored war a decade earlier in Central America.
The Reagan administration wanted to be proactive in sticking it to the communists around the world. President Ronald Reagan authorized the CIA to spend hundreds of millions of dollars building, supporting, directing the Contras against the Sandinistas in Nicaragua.
They are the moral equal of our founding fathers. We cannot turn away from them.
While While the CIA attempted to topple the democratically elected government in Nicaragua, Webb discovered the Contras had ties to the crack explosion in Los Angeles.
Sponsoring violence in a small Central American country was far more important than stopping drugs from flowing into our cities and our communities.
After a year-long investigation, Webb's story was published on the front page of the San Jose Mercury News.
Gary Webb, campaigning journalist.
The central thing that we tried to show, and it wasn't particularly that the CIA knew about it, it was how crack came to be such a problem in America, that it was connected to this Nicaraguan cocaine pipeline.
Webb's report broke new ground by becoming the first major news investigation published both in print and on the Internet.
Susan Paterno, senior contributing writer for the American Journalism Review.
As a consequence, even though the San Jose Mercury News is considered a regional newspaper, it was able to get national traction and even international traction on this story because it was now on the web.
We've got all the DEA undercover tapes, we've got the FBI reports, we've got the court records, and they're all posted for people to see.
Dick Gregory, comedian and author.
Brother Webb, when you look at his research and what he was doing and tracing it, and he was hip enough to check it and know it was true.
By November 1997, the website was getting over 1 million hits a day, and the story made the biggest impact in Los Angeles.
What is the word on the street now? Have you heard about the CIA? Well, you know what? We've heard. We've seen. And now we are moved to action. And we're moved to action in ways that we haven't been...
With the CIA on the defensive and the public demanding answers, the major national newspapers waded into the controversy.
The mainstream media at first responded with pretty much a deafening nothing. But as the story got bigger and bigger, they started responding by blaming Gary Webb.
You have the fact that the San Jose Mercury News, being in Silicon Valley, was sort of challenging the gatekeeper function that the New York Times, the LA Times, the Washington Post, and other big papers had assumed was there.
The CIA and crack, evidence is lacking of alleged plot.
The Washington Post weighs in and says Gary Webb got it wrong, but we can't tell you exactly how he got it wrong because we haven't the faintest goddamn idea.
Some black leaders have fed these fears. These suspicions run much deeper among blacks.
It was accompanied by a piece that declared that the African-American community was conspiracy prone. So that sort of set the tone that Webb's story would be dismissed and, to a degree, ridiculed.
September 21st, the New York Times headlines, John Deutsch, the director of Central Intelligence, insisted there was no evidence.
You had major media outlets going to the CIA and saying, is this true? And the CIA would say, oh, no, this is not true. And then they reported to us, oh, well, it's not true.
Duane Claridge, CIA chief officer, Central America, 1981-84.
This is nonsense. Come on. There has never been a conspiracy in this country.
The fact is that the shoddy reporting on this story was not from Gary Webb. It was from his corporate-backed detractors.
October 21st, 1996, the LA Times reports, but the available evidence fails to support any of those allegations.
Now, I had a drink with a major figure at the LA Times, and I asked him about the crackback. And he said, look, there were meetings in the building that they weren't going to let a guy from San Jose, California, come into their turf and win a Pulitzer Prize.
As the press attacked Gary Webb, the public protested.
I got involved with the protests because Gary Webb, he had no hidden agenda. He's not lying.
And we're going to put the CIA in this country on notice.
With the national media calling for a retraction of Webb's story, his own newspaper took action.
Kurt Webb, Gary's brother.
The Mercury News was behind Gary, 100% while he was writing it. And then because of the backlash from the other media, they also backpedaled away from Gary.
The San Jose Mercury News, May 11th, 97. I believe that we fell short at every step of our process in the writing, editing, and production of our work.
In the beginning, they were behind you.
That's right. And then they caught a world of hell from the establishment media, and now they're not behind me anymore.
The San Jose Mercury News essentially abandoned him.
The pressure paid off when the Mercury News took down the Dark Alliance website and reassigned Webb to a bureau 150 miles from his home.
And here, this guy that had all these awards, this guy that broke a story that everyone warned him not to break, all of a sudden a journalist that should be hailed was treated like a piece of...
A year later, the CIA released its internal report into the agency's involvement with Contra drug traffickers.
Frederick Hitz, Inspector General of the CIA.
There are instances where CIA did not, in an expeditious or consistent fashion, cut off relationships with individuals supporting the Contra program who were alleged to have engaged in drug trafficking activity.
The contents of the reports, if you go into the actual nitty-gritty of them, what you find is that there was a serious problem, that the U.S. government knew about it, and that the Contras were far more guilty of drug trafficking, and the CIA was more guilty of looking the other way than even Gary Webb had suggested.
That report includes a great deal of information and quotes many documents.
With the CIA's report about its relationship with Contra drug traffickers, the media had a chance to vindicate Webb's investigation.
The CIA failed to tell Congress about allegations it had received against at least 8 individuals with Contra ties.
The New York Times, they do a story that is half kind of mea culpa, we should have done more with this, it was worse than we thought, and half Gary Webb's still an idiot. The Washington Post waits several weeks and does a rather dismissive article. And the LA Times never reports on the CIA's findings. So even though Webb was proven correct, he's still considered a flake who got a story wrong.
Gary felt betrayed by his own brethren, if you will. In his mind, the journalist was supposed to expose the truth, not do the opposite, not try to quash it.
As the media buried the CIA's report, Webb found his career at a dead end.
When he was interviewing with another job, they'd always say, "Aren't you the guy who wrote Dark Alliance?" And then that would kill the interview. He couldn't make a living being a journalist anymore. And that ripped his heart out.
He's despondent about his inability to find work. He got his father's pistol, laid out a certificate for his cremation, and then he shot himself.
Frankly, you know, if I have to stand up and take a beating for putting the issue of government complicity in drug trafficking on the national agenda, I'll take that beating any day of the week. I mean, I was glad to do this story. I'm proud of what we did, and I'd do it again in a second.
We killed one of the few decent working reporters in the country. By that, we, I mean the business I'm in, media.
We're now at a stage where every journalist who isn't asleep understands that corporate power has made it impossible for them to do the job as it needs to be done.
Bigger is better.
With the new technological revolution, Congress began drafting new media legislation.
The media conglomerates created the fantasy that if they were allowed to own dramatically more media, they could make dramatically better media. Big is better, effectively.
In order to sell their message, media conglomerates sent their lobbyists to work the halls of Congress.
This was presented to the public as it's all about introducing free market reforms. We were going to take these magical technologies, deregulate, and open up the magic of the free market and let it work its wonders on communication. It was a preposterous claim.
Media corporations need that favorable policy that's going to allow them to grow and make more and more money. And politicians need that media to give them the airtime that they couldn't exist without. Who's left out of that deal, of course, is the public.
Fantasy became reality for the media conglomerates when President Bill Clinton signed the 1996 Telecom Act into law.
Jeff Cohen, founder of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting.
Newt Gingrich was the Republican Speaker of the House. President Clinton is the Democratic White House, and they're both getting millions, literally millions of dollars. At that point, behind closed doors, these media conglomerates are asking for the rules to be loosened even more.
President Clinton used the stately Library of Congress for the backdrop today to sign the massive new telecommunications bill into law.
This law is truly revolutionary legislation that will bring the future to our doorstep.
Telecom 96 really rang the dinner bell for media conglomerates to come and eat up every station that they wanted.
Following the Telecom Act, a wave of massive mergers swept through the media industry.
A handful of entertainment stars using mega mergers are preparing to dominate TV and movie screens worldwide.
The combination of the two together gives us the opportunity to become the strongest creative company in the world.
The superlatives were flying as Viacom and CBS announced the biggest media merger ever.
A new multimedia giant will soon control an enormous amount of the entertainments. Viacom is buying CBS, parent of CBS News.
When you think about the new Viacom, you really only have to remember a single number. That's number one.
Capitalize on the convergence of media, entertainment, and communication.
Almost as American as Apple Pie, the world's largest provider of internet access is merging with the world's largest media and entertainment company.
Sylvia Rivera, managing director of Vocalo.
When media consolidation began to happen, the local broadcasters weren't able to compete. Well, guess who those local radio station owners were? It might have been a person of color, or it might have been a woman. This really just knocked people out of the game.
Media corporations spent around $400 million on lobbying and political contributions between 1998 and 2005.
We've totally destroyed the localism of broadcasting purely to serve corporate interest. There's nothing in market economics that justifies it. It's pure crony capitalism at its worst.
In this high-tech digital age with high-definition television and digital radio, all we ever get is static, a veil of distortion and lies and misrepresentations and half-truths that obscure reality.
Perception is reality. Chris Hedges, foreign correspondent for the New York Times from 1990 to 2005.
In times of war, the press loses all critical distance. Journalists see themselves as first and foremost patriots. The result is essentially the dissemination of propaganda.
In the world's media capital, on September 11th, 2001, the unthinkable happened.
Jonathan Landay, national security correspondent, Knight Ridder.
The terrorist attack of September 11th, as tragic as it was almost like a godsend to the Bush administration because it gave them the raison d'etre that they were looking for to invade Iraq.
To link Saddam Hussein to 9/11, the Bush administration turned to the intelligence community.
Bob Baer, Middle East field officer for the CIA, 1976 to 1997.
You have to remember this is not an inductive process, it's deductive. You decide to go to war, and then you go find a justification, and this is exactly what happened. Hey, look, I ran Iraqi operations. We didn't have any information.
With no evidence of Saddam Hussein's role in the attacks, defectors started emerging from Iraq with exclusives for U.S. news outlets.
Pratap Chatterjee, executive director of Court Watch.
There was an Iraqi by the name of Adnan Ihsan Said al-Haderi
He claimed to have evidence of, you know, biological and nuclear and various kinds of weapons of mass destruction.
He also talked about various facilities being under Saddam's main palace. He talked about nuclear facilities being disguised as water wells. I mean, he was their best corroboration that Saddam was stockpiling weapons of mass destruction.
While the defector appeared to provide the smoking gun against Saddam, the plan to topple the Iraqi dictator was hatched a decade earlier as part of a CIA covert operation.
James Bamford, author and journalist, specialist in the NSA.
During the 1990s, the CIA went outside of the organization and it hired a private corporation called the Rendon Group. What Rendon specializes in is not really espionage, it's perception management. It's changing your views. It's creating an image that may or may not be truthful.
For the propaganda campaign, the Rendon Group created an opposition party to Saddam, the Iraqi National Congress.
The Rendon Group provided tens of millions of dollars to create this political party. There was really kind of a figment of imagination in some ways. It had no real backing in Iraq.
In the wake of 9/11, with the Bush administration determined to make the case for war, they called on the INC.
So what happened was the INC were asked to provide evidence about the weapons of mass destruction, to tell the White House what it wanted to hear. It was a complete act of deceit from the beginning.
They suffered another major blow in Desert Storm and its aftermath. But we now know that Saddam has resumed his efforts to acquire nuclear weapons. Among other sources, we've gotten this from first-hand testimony from defectors.
Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense, 2001 to 2006.
We know where they are. They're in the area around Tikrit and Baghdad and east, west, south, and north somewhat.
The success of their propaganda campaign would depend on one news outlet.
The former employer of Chris Hedges, the New York Times.
They created a stage and brought journalists into the audience who dutifully took notes and reported it. I watched this from the inside. People like Judy Miller, Michael Gordon, Steve Engelberg, who ran the investigation, they were true believers. They believed all the they were fed.
December 20th, 2001, Iraq tells of renovations at sites for chemical and nuclear arms. Quote, an Iraqi defector said he personally worked on renovations of secret facilities for biological, chemical, and nuclear weapons.
The New York Times is the intellectual and political opinion leader in the United States, sucking up to government in the most outrageous ways, constantly trying to placate the military intelligence complex.
There's a story in the New York Times this morning.
Read in the New York Times today.
And I want to tribute the Times, and I want to talk about it. Obviously, it's
closer to acquiring nuclear weapons.
I don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud.
The smoking gun that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
With the mainstream media convinced of the necessity for war, the administration took their case to the world stage.
The coup de grace and the most brilliant propaganda maneuver of all was Colin Powell's absolutely fraudulent presentation in front of the United Nations Security Council.
In the corner of the conference hall is a large, several meters square message, Iraq failing to disarm, February 5th, 2003.
Let me share with you what we know from eyewitness accounts. We have first-hand descriptions of biological weapons factories on wheels and on rails. And Saddam Hussein has not verifiably accounted for even one teaspoonful of this deadly material.
Much of the fabricated information that was passed on by the quote-unquote defectors formed the basis for Colin Powell's accusations.
Why should any of us give Iraq the benefit of the doubt?
He didn't have any hard evidence, but you should have seen the press fall all over themselves as soon as he was done, saying that this had been a definitive case for war.
There's irrefutable, undeniable, incontrovertible evidence today. Colin Powell
brilliantly delivered that smoking gun today.
He just flooded the terrain with data.
Henry Kissinger.
He has closed the deal.
CNN, Fox, CBS, ABC, the giant echo chamber that creates public perception in the United States, were giving out the administration line.
Scores of American reporters have now joined U.S. military units in Kuwait, what the Pentagon calls a media-friendly campaign.
Showdown Iraq. If America goes to war, turn to MSNBC and...
If you looked at the television screens with these graphics and drum rolls and countdown to Baghdad and this kind of stuff, it was a raw and open celebration of American power.
This hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
After the fall of Saddam, al-Hadary, the INC's defector, finally had the chance to show the world the justification for war.
Mr. Hadary couldn't bring these guys to a single place that he claimed had housed the weapons of mass destruction programs. The media fell hook, line, and sinker for the administration's case for war. And in fact, certain publications appear to have been deliberately used and openly receptive of information that the Bush administration produced that was wrong,
White House
but that
press
bolstered
briefing.
Its case for war.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
You'll be there in a minute. King, John King. This is scripted.
Thank you, Mr. President.
You cannot go against the White House and survive. You're finished.
April. Did you have a question, or did I call upon you cold?
I have a question.
Okay. I'm sure you do have a question.
The whole idea in Washington is to marginalize people who go against the consensus, and they do it very well. You don't get invited to the party.
For me to blame the reporters is to miss the point. You have to blame the owners of the media. You have to blame not just Rupert Murdoch, but Arthur Sulzberger, the publisher of the New York Times, Donald Graham, the publisher of the Washington Post, the owners of Viacom, Sumner Redstone. These are the people who are responsible for the conduct of the people who work for them. They set the tone.
All right, everybody get back in the wagon now.
It is my belief that wars really are started by the mainstream media. It is my belief that the press getting too close to big government, actually we are talking about a sort of interbreeding or intermeshing between the structures of the mainstream media and this structure of the military intelligence complex.
The impact is that we've got all of these innocent people in Iraq that have died. We've got thousands of American soldiers and British soldiers that have died. They died for a lie that was so easily uncovered, but it wasn't allowed in the biggest news outlets.
These private corporations are making profit off the killing. They push for more war. It builds their audiences. They limit the discussion about whether war should continue. They bring you the general versus the colonel, or the pro-war Republican versus the pro-war Democrat, and they have these extremely limited debates when most people are outside of that spectrum. Most people are against war.